Namo myoho renge kyo. Hi, good friends. I hope this finds you in good health and secure as usual. A new chapter, I think. We're starting a new chapter. Yep. The Apparitional City. Now, this one, this is a good story. Full of meanings. We are entering the part of the Lotus Sutra now where we're digging into the psychological metrics, if you will, of the operation of our mind, the goal setting of our mind, all within the parameters of the Bodhisattva practice. Shakyamuni has now, in the previous chapters, made clear that there are not three paths, there are not multiple paths, there is only one path, there is only one method for enlightenment, for awaking one's Buddha mind, or Buddha-ness, if you will. In other words, Buddha is a state of mind that is fully aware of the moment-to-moment process of life, the engine of life, right? That everything, all phenomena, human beings, rocks, trees, planets, the universe itself is instantiating itself moment to moment in momentum. Nothing is static. Nothing is just there, right? There was a time a few hundred years ago when human beings looked to the sky at night and thought of all those little bright lights as stationary lights in the night sky. Right? I mean, we know so much more now, but can you imagine? It's not beyond the realm of imagination that it would seem so, right? Even that everything revolved around the Earth rather than the Earth being one of the satellites of the sun in our solar system, right? But 3,000 years, almost 3,000 years ago, Shakyamuni was talking about no thing, not any atom, not any quark, nothing in the universe. Even the quantum fields from which particles are appearing and disappearing, not their informations, their transitioning from quiescence to form, are static. Everything is momentum. That momentum is defined as karma. Karma is that instantiating from formations into form. And so although we read in the Four Noble Truths that to end suffering is to cease the formations, the cravings and clinging, depending on which version you read, that the subtlety that is absolutely the crux of Buddhism that you must understand is that there is no getting rid of, there's no ceasing of the formations per se, and this is the difficulty of language, what we want to cease is the clinging and craving to the process of the formations into form. It's not that karma is good or bad. It's our samsaric mind wanting to adhere to maintain a permanence, a staticity, if you will, of that karma. Karma isn't stationary either. Everything reinstantiates itself based on the influences, the circumstances, the conditions, and its tendencies moment to moment. You really, really have to think hard and understand the implications of that. Right? We're so samsaric, it's almost painful to really, really let go of all of the myriad words and ideas and thoughts and attachments to everything we think. It's just like thinking about infinity. It's a completely useless concept, truly useless. It's even scientists don't even talk Buddhism. They have problems resolving the ultimate in their mathematics or their observations, in their mathematics specifically, because they try to interpret mathematics as a language too, right? Don't be fooled. So as complex and minute as mathematics can resolve things, it's still an interpretation. Right? So the biggest problem they have in the maths of the infinitely small, the quantum, and the infinitely large, infinite, is infinity. So they fudge. Because you can't have an infinity. It's like dividing by zero. It's just, yeah, you can write it down and you could say you're doing that, but it's meaningless. And the meaninglessness of it, it breaks all the other logic. Because if you allow for that, then nothing else is required. So infinity, that is a playful concept that everybody uses to their particular definition. It's not helpful, right? Because everything, the entirety of the universe, exists in moments. Moments moving. Moments with kinetic energy. Moments that are, by the nature of their occurrence, a momentum. You can't take quiescence and do something to it in order to form something without having transitioned. That transition itself is kinetic. It's energy moving. Everything is that way. When it isn't, it's quiescent. It's not doing anything. It just has the potential to do something. Right? You could look at this entire universe as just this little this little loop. This is why this filters down to the very basics of Buddhism. This is why an idea of an afterlife is nonsense. It's not even worth discussing. This lifetime, what we call it, is just a loop of a tremendous box of potential, a box of karma. And that box keeps growing, moving by virtue of its influence, what surrounds it. That's why the illusion of separateness from environment is truly that. Because the environment is a reflection of and an influence to every moment we experience. They're not separate things. Right? Skin coming off. Oh, it's been raining a bit today, so you may hear some rain. But I'm going to keep throwing that in every way I can, because this has to click at some point. This is the big aha, the renge, that when we use our mandala, we focus on myoho, right? Potential instantiation. And we're chanting, we're saying, I'm here, I'm present, and I'm absorbed in this renge. When it clicks, everything is viewed anew, experienced anew. That's Buddha, that experience. That's what we want to maintain. All right. The apparitional city. The Buddha addressed the monks saying, quote, once upon a time, immeasurable, limitless, inconceivable, incalculable kalpas ago, long before Star Wars, right? Remember the writing coming down saying in a galaxy far, far away? So this is incalculable kalpas ago, just long time ago, yeah? There was a Buddha called, here we go with these Indian names. Please bear with me. Wow, I haven't heard that one before. Mahabijnasnabibu. Tathagata. A fully enlightened, completely enlightened, perfect in knowledge and conduct, well departed, knower of the world, unsurpassed, tamer of humans, teacher of devas, right? A Buddha, a Bhagavat. His land was called Susambhava, in the Kalpa called Maharupa. Interesting, Maharupa, that would be the great forming, or the great form, right? Interesting name. O monks, it has been an extremely long time since this Buddha entered Nirvana. Suppose, that's an interesting translation there. The Buddha entered Nirvana. You enter Nirvana when you become a Buddha, or you open your Buddha-ness. So this must be the second type of Nirvana, right? With no remainder. But see, that's never made clear in these translations, so these terms become confusing. Ergo, I've created the first volume of Buddhism reference to start to clear these things up. I'm working on the second volume, the first volume, of course, available as an ebook or a print book. All the links are in the description. Or go to threefoldlotus.com. You'll see that whole first page is full of links to these different things. Suppose there were a man, he goes on, who ground the earth of an entire great manifold cosmos into powdered ink. Here we go with these huge hyperbolic analogies, right, or metaphors. And he were to then pass through a thousand worlds to the east, and worlds are not the earth. Worlds are the entire solar system and all those little dots of lights. That's our world system, yeah? And you can look that up. Is that the first volume or second volume? I'm going to start getting confused now. But it will be in Buddhism reference. Where he let fall a single particle of ink the size of a speck of dust. So here we go. We've heard this kind of measurement before. And it's always a mix of time and space, isn't it? Again, to try to expand the mind to conceptualize something bigger than one's home or farm or community, right? People didn't travel a whole lot, except for scholars back in the day, in his day. And, you know, looking at the sky and the mountains in the distance was about as much as they could conceive. So he was really trying to push them to conceive of a much greater, a much vaster location. And certainly this is equatable to the Buddha mind, which perceives far greater, far more vast a reality than simply one's food, shelter, and sex. After passing through another thousand worlds, he let fall another particle every 1,000 worlds. Woo! This is already inconceivable, isn't it? And he continued in this way until he had completely used all the ink. Oh, man. Okay, we'll see ya. What do you think about this? He says. Do you think that a mathematician or a mathematician's pupil would be able to count those worlds to the last particle or not? Well, we're already lost. Maybe a super talented mathematician could take all of these numbers and reduce it, but he'd have to start by an estimation of how many particles of dust, of ink, did he create out of crushing this entire cosmos. Right? Oh, Bhagavad, no, they could not. Oh, monks, suppose that all the worlds this man passed through, whether letting fall a particle or not, were all ground into dust. Here we go with the multiplication, yeah? And one speck of this dust were equal to one kalpa. Yikes. How long is a kalpa? Really long. It's like the time since the parinirvana of this Buddha surpasses this number by immeasurable, limitless, incalculable hundreds of thousands of myriads of kotas of kalpas. And through the power of the Tathagata's wisdom and insight, I can see his distant past as if it were today. Thereupon, the Bhagavad, wanting to elaborate on the meaning of this, spoke further in these verses. So what do you think he's saying there? He's going to say it again in the Honmon section, right? The essential teachings in the second half of the Lotus Sutra. But he's already setting the ground. He's saying this is another Buddha, but and people, samsaric people hung up on physicalness, right? Materialness. Think of this other Buddha as a thing, a person, a man. They still are not, they're not getting that Renge moment yet. That Buddha ain't no man. It's a state of awareness. And what Shakyamuni's preparing them to hear is that that state of awareness has always been available, but not until you and I, with our sentient minds, have we been able to experience it. That's awakening. That's Renge. That's enlightenment. That's turning the light on in the attic full of debris and boxes and unknowable quantities. Right? He's already telling them, but because they can't see it yet, he's preparing the ground so this doesn't come as something so different. So it will, but they will have some basis on which to seize upon it, have an insight, yeah? So here we go in verse. I recall that in the past, immeasurable kalpas ago, and now you have an idea what that implies, right? There was a Buddha, the most honored among two-legged beings. So it can't be before human beings existed, but for the purposes of illustration, as he's said so many times, called, very long word, I may substitute his name for that, Mahabijnajnanabibhu. Suppose there was a man who vigorously ground up in its entirety the earth of the great manifold cosmos. Not this earth as in the planet, but the earth, the constituent parts of the great manifold cosmos, the triclocosm, tricholiocosm. That's in the book too. And turned it all into powdered ink. After passing through 1,000 worlds, he let fall one particle of ink. And in this way, he continued to let fall particles until he'd used up all the ink. If all these worlds, those were where he left a particle fall, and those where he did not, because, right, he went 1,000 worlds before he dropped another particle, were to be ground into specks of dust, and one speck of dust were equal to a single kalpa, Their number would be surpassed by the number of kalpas that have passed since the Buddha's parinirvana. So incalculable has this number of kalpas been. Another way of saying it, without time, right? And Buddha's always playing with this concept of time and space. And for good reason, because if you can, if your mind breaks at the prospect of thinking, how long is this? Then it becomes a little easier for you to understand that there is no how long this is. It's a moment-to-moment ising. Right? That becomes a little easier to understand. Because if it goes to the ridiculous amount that you can't possibly conceive of, it kind of breaks your samsaric static thingifying of it. It becomes so conceptual that your existence becomes a little unhinged, doesn't it? Easier then to make the transition to thinking, I am in this moment and into the next moment, but whatever I was or whatever I experienced as me 10 seconds ago, 10 minutes ago, 10 years ago, no longer valid. I'm not that anymore. I'm this-ing. I'm this-ing. I'm being. Oh, verb. Wow. Yeah. With the Tathagata's unobstructed wisdom, unobstructed by what? Samsaric attachment, craving, clinging. With the Tathagata's unobstructed wisdom, I know of these bodhisattvas and shravakas and the parinirvana of this Buddha, it is as if I see this parinirvana today. I'm experiencing time in this moment. No longer based on the ruler and measurement of time, only this experience, moment to moment, of momentum, which resembles time, but really isn't. I know that, right? Breaking the brain a bit. Oh, monks, you should know that the knowledge of the Buddha, which is pure and subtle, incorrupted and without obstructions, I perceive what happened immeasurable kalpas ago, as though it's happening right now. Which is also something I've told you about memory. Memory is a kind of a samsaric trick. Because even if you remember, you're rebirthing a memory, right? Think about it. Whatever you think now of that memory, it is not the same as what it was when you experienced it. That's gone. And what you're remembering now has been colored, influenced, added to, subtracted from, even at night in your dreams, when your brain is resorting this information and saying, that's valuable, that's not. That's why the day after you've done something differently the day before, you often have insights. Because you're working on it. But those insights and what you know now isn't what you knew then. It's different. That's not to say what happened didn't happen. It's just to say that a memory isn't a secure document or a rubber stamp of, right? Never is, because what you experience in this moment is in this moment. And in the next moment will be modified. Just because you may not see that, we do it all the time though, right? How many times do you catch yourself saying, I do it in these videos. I'll be talking about something, and I'll, oh, that makes me think this. Well, that's new. I didn't pull it out of a file cabinet and go, here's a memory. I'm recreating. That's what we do all the time. The Buddha addressed the monks saying, the lifespan of this Buddha, Maha, so on, was 540 myriad of codis of nayutas of kalpas. Again, meaningless, meaningful only in his extended breaking of our mental conception of time. Okay? When that Buddha was seated on the terrace of enlightenment, after having defeated Mara's army, he tried to obtain highest and complete enlightenment, yet the Dharma of the Buddha did not appear to him. In the experience of Buddha-ness, the Dharma of the Buddha. In this way, even after having sat cross-legged for 1 to 10 intermediate kalpas, but he got a cramp, undisturbed in body and mind, the Dharma of the Buddhas still did not appear to him. At that time, a group of 33 devas first prepared for that Buddha a lion seat, 1 yohana in height, under the Bodhi tree. Could he be maybe describing his own process of enlightenment here? Is he not giving himself an ancient name to just simply describe his own experience of self, 6 years of self practice and enlightenment, searching for this Buddhahood, this truth? I think so. For this Buddha was to attain highest complete enlightenment on that seat. Under the Bodhi tree, isn't that the story of Shakyamuni, Siddhartha Gautama, sitting there for 6 years? As soon as the Buddha sat on this seat, all the Brahmas rained down various heavenly flowers for 100 yohanas around. Periodically, a fragrant breeze would blow away the withered flowers, and they would rain down fresh ones. This process of renge. Flowers. It's very consistent if you're attuned to the rhetoric and you know what to expect here, right? When you first read the Lotus Sutra, you have none of this background information. It all seems like poetry and hyperbole and so on and so forth. But knowing the expectation of the teachings, rereading the Lotus Sutra, oh, I understand what this is about, right? Again, that's the benefit of study. Things become self-evident. Just like Nichiren talks about it. It's like, duh, how do you not get this, right? In this way, he continues, unceasingly paid homage to the Buddha for a full 10 immediate kalpas, raining down these flowers continuously until his parinirvana. So the implication is that this was still happening while he was teaching. The devas of the four quarters constantly struck heavenly drums to honor the Buddha, and in the same way, all the other devas made divine music for a full 10 intermediate kalpas until his parinirvana. Now, obviously, we know it took around 6 years. So his conceptions of time are the experiential mental perception of time, which we've talked about many times, right? The same length of time can seem interminable if you have a lot of anticipation, or if something gets accomplished, that same sort of time can seem, once it's accomplished, as though, well, that didn't take long. But in the midst of it, it may seem like forever, quote unquote. Time. O monks, the Dharma of the Buddhas, the experience of Buddha-ness, appeared to the Buddha after 10 intermediate kalpas had passed, and he attained highest complete enlightenment. Again, this is all a re-envisioning of his own time spent to enlightenment. Whether his audience sees that or not, I'm not prepared to say, right? Still, the example is noteworthy. This Buddha had had 16 children before he renounced household life. The eldest child was called Jnanakara. Each child had various kinds of rare toys. After hearing about their father's attainment of highest complete enlightenment, they all put aside their toys and set out for where the Buddha was. Weeping sad tears, their mothers saw them off. Their grandfather, the wheel-turning sage king, went with them, along with 100 ministers and hundreds of thousands of myriads of kodas of people. So, it was an amazing event, and thousands of people, along with his immediate family, not Shakyamuni's, but this story he's making up, all wanted to meet this Buddha, right? Certainly his children did. When they arrived at the Terrace of Enlightenment, they all wanted to approach the Tathagata Mahabhijna Jnana Bihu and pay homage and respect, honor and praise him. They came up to him and bowed until their foreheads touched his feet and then circled around him, right? They do that three times. Attentively, with palms pressed together, they gazed at the Bhagavat and spoke these verses. The Bhagavat of great virtuous dignity, in order to bring sentient beings to the path, after immeasurable kodas of kalpas and perfecting all the vows, finally became a Buddha. How wonderful! There is nothing more auspicious. The Bhagavat is truly extraordinary. He sat tranquil for 10 intermediate kalpas with his body and limbs immobile. Think again about time here. All of these people somehow are aware of all these intermediate kalpas that this guy's been sitting there trying to reach enlightenment. How old is everyone? Right? So they too must have felt a great deal of anticipation for this. There's our scale of time, right? His mind was always calm and never distracted. He has attained ultimate eternal tranquility and is firmly established in the incorruptible Dharma, the experience of Buddhaness. Now seeing the Bhagavat, who has serenely attained the Buddha path, it's still a path, we receive benefit and celebrate with great joy. What is the Buddha path? Bodhisattva. Sentient beings, ever suffering, are blind and without a teacher. They are unaware of the path that leads to the extinction of suffering, Four Noble Truths, ignorant of the way to seek liberation from one blind state to the next. Those in the troubled states of being daily increase, while the devas decrease. They never hear the Buddha's name. Now the Buddha has attained the highest, serene, and incorruptible Dharma. Thus, we and the devas and humans shall obtain the greatest benefit. Therefore, we all bow and pay homage to the highest Lord, or the highest teacher, the highest leader. Right? At that time, the 16 princes, having praised the Buddha in verse, requested that the Bhagavat turn the wheel of the Dharma, saying, quote, O Bhagavat, teach the Dharma, put all the devas and people at ease, and benefit them through your compassion. They spoke further in verse, saying, O hero of the world, the one who has no equal, who is adorned with 100 merits or rewards, and has attained the highest wisdom, we entreat you to teach for the sake of the world, and bring us and all other sentient beings to the path, the Buddha way. Illuminate and reveal this wisdom so that they may attain it. If we can become Buddhas, so can the other sentient beings. The Bhagavat knows the deep-seated intentions of sentient beings and the paths they practice, as well as the power of their wisdom, their potential, right? May the Bhagavat being completely aware of their positive intention, right? Accumulated rewards, merits, and past deeds turn the highest wheel of the Dharma, the Buddha experience. Now, at this point, I'm sure Shakyamuni didn't think, well, he might have thought, well, I did that once, it didn't work out, but maybe now they're ready. Since they've had 42 years of instruction, maybe now I can drop this mic on them and they'll hear it. The Buddha addressed the monks saying, quote, when the Buddha Mahabijnasana Bibhu attained highest complete enlightenment, 500 myriads of kodas of Buddha worlds in each of the 10 directions quaked in six ways. This really rattled people's minds. The dark places between the worlds where the rays of the sun and moon had been unable to penetrate were brightly illuminated. What do you think he's talking about there? He's talking about our minds. Buddhism is always about the mind. So the universe, no different than your mind. The dark spaces in between are the dark spaces. Scientists use this analogy today. Dark matter, dark energy. It's just unseeable. And what he's now saying, Shakyamuni, is when you reach this Renge, this Buddha-ness, nothing is unseeable. There is no darkness. It's fully illuminated. Like my little analogy about the attic turning on the light. Yeah. It's that simple. Yeah. The sentient beings there were able to see each other and said, yeah, because in the dark they can't. How is it possible that sentient beings have suddenly appeared here? Well, they haven't suddenly appeared. You just wouldn't see them before, right? Just like that dark attic. Moreover, those worlds from the heavenly palaces on up to the palaces of the Brahmas also quaked in six ways. The great ray of light shone everywhere, filling the worlds with a radiance that has surpassed the light of the devas. At that time, the palaces of Brahmas in the 500 myriad of kotas of worlds in the east were illuminated twice as brightly as usual. The great Brahmas each thought, the palaces are illuminated now as never before. What has caused this phenomena? Now, you remember, he's telling the story. It wasn't too long ago that he illuminated everyone in the audience. So they certainly have a basis of thinking about this. It just keeps growing larger and larger, right? At that time, all of the great Brahmins approached each other to discuss the matter. In that assembly, there was a great Brahma called Sarastavatratar, who spoke to the assembly of Brahmins in verse saying, this illumination of our palaces has never occurred before. Let us find out the reason for this. This great light, this great ray of light, has illuminated the 10 directions. Has a deva of great merit been born? Or has a Buddha appeared in the world? Then the great Brahmas of the 100 myriad of kotas of worlds went toward the west with their palaces to inquire about, with their palaces? Wow. Inquire about this phenomena, carrying heavenly flowers in their robes. They saw the Tathagata Mahabijnana Bibhu on the terrace of enlightenment, sitting on the lion's seat under the Bodhi tree. He was respectfully surrounded by humans and such non-humans as devas, nagas, kings, gandharvas, kimnaras, and mahoragas. They also saw the 16 princes requesting the Buddha to turn the wheel of the Dharma. Then the great Brahmas bowed until their foreheads touched the Buddha's feet. and then circled around him 100,000 times. But that took an afternoon. They scattered heavenly flowers on the Buddha, and flowers they scattered were piled as high as Mount Sumeru. They also paid homage to the Buddha's Bodhi tree, which was 10 yohanas in height. Having reverently offered him flowers, they presented their palaces to the Buddha, saying, "Please accept the palaces we now offer you and benefit us through your compassion." Then the great Brahma spoke these verses wholeheartedly and in unison before the Buddha. "The Bhagavat, who is truly extraordinary, is extremely difficult to meet. He is endowed with immeasurable qualities and seeks to protect all. The great teacher of devas and humans feels compassion for the world and causes all sentient beings in the 10 directions to be universally benefited. All of us who have come from 500 of myriads of kodas of worlds have given up the pleasure of deep meditation in order to pay homage to the Buddha. To the Bhagavat, we now present our palaces, which the merits of our previous life have caused to be completely adorned. Please accept them through your compassion." Thereupon, having praised the Buddha in verse, the great Brahmas each said this: "O Bhagavat, we entreat you to turn the wheel of the Dharma, open the path to Nirvana, and guide sentient beings to it." Then the great Brahmas attentively spoke these verses in unison: "O hero of the world, the most honored among two-legged beings, we entreat you to expound the Dharma and bring the suffering beings to the path through the power of your great compassion." Then the Tathagata Mahabhijnana Bibhu silently consented. Okay. "Furthermore, O monks, the great Brahmas in the 500 myriads of kodas of worlds in the southeast saw their palaces illuminated with a ray of light that had never occurred before. Joyful and ecstatic, they were struck with wonder. They assembled to discuss this matter. At that time, there was a great Brahma called Adimatrakarunika. He spoke to the assembly of Brahmas in verse, saying, 'What is the reason that this phenomena has appeared? Even since the olden times, this illumination of all our palaces is without precedent. Has a deva of great merit been born, or has the Buddha appeared in the world? Since we have never seen such a phenomena, we should seek thoroughly for its source, even if we have to pass through thousands of myriads of kotas of worlds. We should seek together for the source of this light. Possibly a Buddha has appeared in the world to save suffering sentient beings.'" Ooh, I've been going on and on. All right. "Thereupon, 500 myriads of kodas of great Brahmas went toward the northwest with their palaces, carrying heavenly flowers in their robes." Seems like quite a repetition, doesn't it? He hasn't gotten to the palace story yet, but it's an engaging story, all talking about time, all discussing this great anticipation and the surprise of its fulfillment. Yeah, how is this going to turn into Renge? How is this going to turn into a major insight? Well, that's coming. Yeah. Anyway, thanks for being here. We'll continue in the next video. Thank you for your practice. Especially thank you for your support. This resource is meant to encourage and bring confidence to our practice. Yes. So if you have comments in that regard as to what else I might explore, especially as we read these several translations of the Lotus Sutra, let's be encouraged, right, to always have great conviction with each daimoku that we are opening up that Gohanzen mind so that we can see with our Buddha capacity. Okay? Links in the description. You know what to do. Patrons, you guys are absolutely, I consider you all patrons, but some of you have the good fortune to be able to send financial donations, and that is tremendous. It helps me publish these books and keep this website going and channel and so forth. So humbly grateful for your support. Take care of your health. Please be kind to yourself. And I'll see you in the next one. All right? Bye for now.